Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to The Brian Lehr Show on WNYC. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. I'm a reporter in the newsroom, and I'm filling in for Brian Lehr for the next couple days. The line between soldier and civilian and the definition of war has gotten hazy, according to Rosa Brooks. She is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a law professor at Georgetown University, former counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon, and she is author of the new book, How Everything Became War and War Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. It's part memoir, part journalism. She writes about her experiences as a civilian at the Pentagon and her work as an international human rights lawyer. And she warns of the unintended consequences of the changing role of the military. Rosa, thank you so much for joining us and welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
All right. So you write that a generation ago, the role of the military and the job of soldiers was pretty clear. It was to defend and take or retake territory and to kill people or break stuff. That's a quote. Today, you say that being a soldier is a little different. Soldiers analyze computer codes from an office building in Virginia. They train Afghan judges. They work on agricultural programs in Africa. They build Ebola isolation wards. And this one's my favorite. The Department of Defense is also developing soap operas for audiences in Pakistan and Iraq.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Most military personnel these days do not actually fight, contrary to popular mythology. That doesn't mean that we don't have people still doing what we think of when we think of World War II movies, which is putting themselves into enormous danger, you know, crawling around in the mud and dirt, getting into firefights and ambushes. We do still have people who do that, but 85% of American military personnel are not in combat positions at all. And even those in combat positions often find themselves, just because of what the nation feels that it needs, doing things that are just radically different than I think what most of us tend to think about. You know, it's helping Afghan women with micro enterprise loans or something like that.
And these are nation building efforts, I would imagine.
Not just nation building. I think we have military personnel right now deployed almost every country in the world. Not every country, but awfully close. And we're not necessarily nation building. In many cases, we are engaged in activities that are intended to build relationships with foreign militaries, build relationships with foreign populations, help us gather information. Because in a world in which you have no idea where the next threat could come from, who expected a threat from Afghanistan on September 10th, 2001? You know, when you have absolutely no idea where the next threat will come from or what it's going to be, you start investing in building relationships all over the world.
And in what ways are soldiers qualified to do some of these things, like train Afghan judges? There's a quote in your book from a worker at the Agency for International Development who says, quote, "You've got these kids, these 30-year-old captains who've spent their lives learning to drive tanks and shoot people, and they think they know how to end poverty in Afghanistan in 6 months."
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, we're putting our military personnel often in an impossible position, which is to say we're sending them places and we're saying this is what we want you to do, and it very often is something for which they have no particular training, which means that sometimes they get lucky and they do it well, and other times, more often, they don't. They don't do it particularly well. I think if we think that this is the future of the military, a whole separate set of questions about should this be what we want our military to do. But if it is, I think the military has for a long time a little bit been in denial, saying, oh, this is just temporary. We don't need to train people to do this because obviously this is just aberrational. But if this is the new normal, that has really pretty radical implications for how we train, how we recruit, and for that matter, for what we think a military is.
And one of the questions you pose is, you know, if today's soldier is sitting in an office somewhere in the United States and never sees a battlefield, are they still a soldier? Why does that definition matter?
You know, it gets into a whole other set of categories that in some ways are totally arbitrary, but have enormous political and legal significance. We have a completely different set of legal rules governing war compared to the rules that govern peace. We have a different set of legal rules that apply to what soldiers do in wartime that's very different from what civilians can do in peacetime. So when we call someone a soldier as opposed to a civilian, when we say that there is a war, or legally speaking, we call it an armed conflict as opposed to something else, we trigger a whole set of legal rules that says, I mean, to put it in its bluntest possible terms, right? In peacetime, you can't go out and kill people. You'll be arrested and charged with murder. In wartime, you might even get a medal if you kill somebody. You're supposed to kill people. And it's not just about actual violence. It's also the wartime law permits much greater use of government coercion, much greater government secrecy, doesn't require the kinds of democratic accountability mechanisms that are common in peacetime. Take something like NSA surveillance. If it's wartime surveillance directed against enemies, you don't have to have democratic checks and balances or individual due process. If it's peacetime, we feel really differently about it. And the same is true for detention. The same is true for targeted strikes such as drone strikes. The same is true just for the degree of secrecy we're willing to tolerate in government programs.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. If you have a question for my guest, Rosa Brooks, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Rosa, you talk about this, the definition of war. You know, the United States has been fighting sort of shapeless enemies for a while, not countries, not places with geographical boundaries, but ideologies. And the defining war, as you say, is actually pretty important because of the laws that govern war. Have these laws that govern war adapted to the time? Are they sort of outdated?
They're becoming somewhat outdated. I think it's not that there's anything wrong with the legal frameworks as such, but the law of armed conflict is what we lawyers call the lex specialis, which is a really fancy Latin way of saying it's special law. As opposed to lex generalis, the general law, and special law applies in special circumstances. If you will, think of it as it's a law for an unusual, exceptional state of affairs. And the legal framework for war takes for granted that war is not the norm, that the norm is peace, and that every now and then you have a war. And every now and then during those war, you apply that special law, which is much more tolerant of secrecy, violence, et cetera, and that's okay because it just happens within this sort of bounded period of time we call a war, and then we go back to normal, back to protecting individual rights, due process, checks and balances, and so forth. The trouble is, in the post-September 11th universe that we've all been inhabiting for the last 15 years, it's gotten harder and harder to figure out what counts as war. We decided after 9/11 to treat terrorist threats, even though they were transnational and not directed by states at all or their militaries, we decided to treat that as armed conflict. Increasingly, the U.S. is looking at things like cyber threats through the framework of armed conflict. And as we stick more and more stuff in that box labeled war, and war stops being the exception, you know, the exception starts overwhelming the norm. So a body of rules designed for exceptional circumstances becomes the body of rules that we almost always apply to U.S. government actions overseas and increasingly domestically as well.
Right. So I get domestically, one example of that would be the use of the military bomb squad robot that was used to kill the guy who killed five police officers in Dallas. Right? There's a line of, you know, military kind of blurring into United States police activity.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of different things going on at the same time. And I talk in my book a little bit about what I call trickle down war. The ways in which the rules and the habits and practices we associate with wartime, when war stops ever having an end, they start kind of trickling down into all kinds of unexpected areas domestically, including criminal law and policing practices and immigration practices and so forth. You know, I think that the use of a bomb robot in and of itself doesn't necessarily pose any legal challenges. And indeed, police in that setting used it in the context of peacetime rules. But you certainly do see a kind of spillover of uniforms, practices, equipments, when it comes to policing. We've had a lot of very expensive government programs designed to provide surplus military equipment from Iraq and Afghanistan to police departments through Homeland Security grants. So we're seeing police who certainly look more like soldiers, what we traditionally think of as soldiers, act more like what we traditionally think of soldiers, even ironically, as many military personnel are doing things that look more like what civilian police might do overseas.
Okay, and I think we have a caller, Jack from Brooklyn, has a comment about soldiers during wartime. Jack, yeah, you're on WNYC.
Hi. In the Second World War, most of our military didn't see combat. In fact, there were hundreds of thousands of men that were in the military that never left the United States, that did not go to Europe, did not go to the Pacific. And even the ones that did go to the Pacific, the overwhelming majority of men did not see, confront hand-to-hand combat. So there's nothing new about soldiers not crawling through the mud and being shot at. And also, at the end of the Second World War, most of our soldiers were helping the Germans and the Japanese run their cities. Maybe not doing exactly what they're doing today, but they were doing things like helping, you know, create new legal systems in Germany and in Japan, just the same way as you were discussing today. And this is I'm talking about 1946, 1947. So there's nothing new about what you said.
Rosa, Jack, thank you for your call. Rosa, do you want to respond to that?
I think there is, in fact, a lot that's new. I mean, the caller, Jack, is absolutely right. Of course, you know, we had plenty. In every war, there are soldiers who never end up fighting. And in many past conflicts, we've also had, and in many, let me answer your question here. In many past conflicts, we've also had situations such as post-World War II Japan and Germany, where we had lots of military personnel conducting what we call nation-building activities. But the ratio, the percentage of American military personnel who are not in combat occupational specialties and who never deploy has gone up quite dramatically since that time. You know, so it's not that we've never seen it before, absolutely, but the percentage of people it affects is changed quite significantly. The number of countries around the world in which we now have military personnel deployed, not engaged in what we traditionally think of as combat, has also expanded quite dramatically. I mean, it's a huge, huge shift.
Okay. Jack, what do you think about that?
You may be right there, but the impression you gave before was that most soldiers, until now, had combat roles, and that just was never true. Maybe the ratio has
changed. Yeah, and I will encourage you. I hope you will go out and buy my book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, because I don't think I do say that in the book. I think it's a more complicated picture.
But listening to you before, that's kind of what the impression I had.
All right. Thanks, Jack, for your call. Rosa, speaking about, you know, the title of your book, How the Military Became Everything, you give us the impression that the Defense Department, the Pentagon, is this enormous agency. But you think the Defense Department's budget should be even larger. You think the military should be bigger.
No, that's not what I say. I think that it's pretty problematic what has happened in terms of shifting all these roles to the Pentagon. I also think, however, that if the military is going to be asked to do these things, they need to learn how to do them well. That does not necessarily mean in any way bigger budgets. It does mean thinking very, very differently about how we recruit and how we train.
So can you give us some examples?
Yeah, so one example, it's maybe a slightly extreme one, but I got myself in hot water a few years ago by writing a column for Foreign Policy magazine, sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, in which I argued that the military should stop recruiting high school boys and start recruiting senior citizens at AARP conferences. And everybody kind of said, well, that's ridiculous. But think about it like this. We still recruit. Our military still recruits as if the conflicts we're fighting are these sort of mid-19th century conflicts that are all about brawn. And that's why we continue to recruit most heavily among high school kids, particularly, you know, the 85% of our new recruits are basically young men between 18 and 22 or so. And young men between 18 and 22 are exactly who you need if you think that most of your service members are going to be doing, you know, long marches with heavy loads and getting into firefights. And on the other hand, if you think, as in fact has become the case, that most military personnel most of the time are going to be writing computer code or assisting with economic development enterprises or training judges, it's not particularly obvious that your, you know, 18 to 22 year old male is the perfect recruiting target. If those are the activities that you want, you'd want to really diversify who you recruit, how you recruit, the degree to which people can come in and out of the military without messing up their career path and sacrificing seniority. You'd want to have a system where you can recruit older people with more specialized skills, where they can leave the military for a few years, go to a university, go to the private sector, whatever it may be, come back without losing seniority, where military personnel could do the same thing. You'd want to send your smart majors off to go work at, you know, Google or Facebook for a couple of years, then bring them back in without messing up their career paths. Right now, we do that very poorly.
Do you think that more people should serve in the military?
I don't think it's a question of more. I think it's a question of who and how. I think that if we, depending on what we want to do, I actually am a big fan of universal national service, including not just a military option, but also more Peace Corps-like and VISTA and AmeriCorps kinds of activities. So I don't think it's so much about sheer numbers. It's about thinking harder about what are we trying to do and what is the mix of skills. And to be clear, I'm also not saying that the, you know, old-fashioned war is going anywhere. The sort of traditional, you know, look at Syria right now. People are being killed the old-fashioned way, and that is unfortunately going to continue. I think that the real challenge for the American military and for the rest of us, and it has institutional components and legal and political pieces to it, is if the future is that old-fashioned war continues and we also face these much more complex, much more diffuse kinds of threats, and we think that there's no institution other than the military that has the sort of the sheer manpower or the money to take those on, how do we rethink? How do we rethink how we recruit, how we train, how we fund? How do we rethink the role of civilian organizations? And how do we make sure that the legal rules for war don't end up completely displacing the peacetime rules that protect individual rights?
Okay, I want to go to a caller. We have Jim in Manhattan. Jim has the question about whether you think there's an area of the military budget that we could cut. Jim, you're on WNYC.
Oh, hi. My question is, if we really paid attention to, in your opinion, if we paid attention to waste eliminating unnecessary weapon systems and eliminating wasteful spending that benefits corporate interests, do you think that we could significantly cut our military budget at the same time, pay our soldiers way better and take care of our veterans way better and save money in the process? As an outsider looking in, it always seems as if, you know, the $50 hammer thing is a real thing. The burning of computers and cars in Iraq with the cost plus stuff, contracting, that so much tax dollars is wasted on military and that we could be just as safe for a lot less money. Do you think that's true?
I think there's definitely some truth to that. And I'll tell you a story. One of the things that kind of shocked me when I was at the Pentagon, every year, of course, the Defense Department, like all the other U.S. government agencies, puts together a budget proposal, sends it off to Congress saying, here's how much money we want, here's why. And congressional committees mark it up and send it back revised. And I took for granted that usually the tension between the Defense Department and the Congress is over the Defense Department saying, you know, we want, you know, this much money, and Congress coming back and saying, well, you can't have that much money, you have to have less. So every year the Secretary of Defense writes what's colloquially known in the Pentagon as a heartburn letter. after the congressional committee send back the budget request. And when I was at the Pentagon while Secretary Robert Gates was Defense Secretary, I remember looking at his heartburn letter and being kind of astounded. There were 13 or 14 bullet points on it of, you know, things that he was objecting to that Congress was trying to do that he thought were wrong. I would have expected that, you know, 11 or 12 of those things at least would be, we asked you for X amount of money, you would only give us part of X, and we need more. But in fact, it was the opposite. Almost everything Secretary Gates was complaining about was saying things like, dear Congress, we told you we did not want this weapon system because it is wasteful, it is ineffective, and it doesn't work, and you're making us have it. We told you that we don't want this much money for such and such a program because we can't use it and we can't spend it responsibly, and you're telling us we have to have the money. Stop it. And ironically, you know, I mean, the nature of our political system, depressingly, is almost every member of Congress and member of the Senate has, you know, they have a military base or a defense manufacturer in their districts, and they don't want to let go of stuff that helps their constituents. So even when the military itself is saying, we don't want it, we don't need it, it's a waste, Congress is sort of shoving money down everybody's throat. You know, at the same time, I'll disagree a little bit with the other piece of what you said. The biggest source, the most rapidly rising costs in the defense budget relate to things like health care and pension and retirement benefits and so forth for military personnel. I'm married to an Army officer who just retired after about 25 years in the Army, and I can tell you that the benefits and pay are really quite extraordinarily generous compared to what people in the civilian world get. And there was a period of time up and before 9/11, at which the pay and benefits for military personnel were really lagging behind civilian counterparts, and now the opposite is true. So I don't think the problem, you know, despite some real issues with the VA system and so forth, with, you know, which have to be addressed, I don't think the problem there is not enough money. I think the problem when it comes to pay and benefits has more to do with, you know, program quality and accountability.
All right. Thank you so much, Jim, for your call. I want to go to Dan in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Dan, you're on WNYC. Dan, are you there? No. Okay, well, maybe we'll come back to Dan in a second. Rosa, I'm curious. Oh, Dan, are you there now? Okay. Hey, Dan, no, you're on WNYC.
You know, you kind of noted this, but the military has become sort of the way in which all sorts of expenditures are shortcutted, and in the end, you're left in a position where you have to validate tremendous amounts of money, which the Defense Department had nothing to do with. But we're also in this problem now where the military is being used not as a global military force, but as a global police force, and we are executing people with drones and so on. We're doing all these advanced actions to prevent war, which are acts of war. And I wonder how you're going to disentangle this kind of political use of the military way out of the warfare situation into this gray war zone where we're on and on and on all the time, killing people and...
Okay, thanks, Dan. Rosa? Yeah.
No, I think, Dan, that's exactly the problem, is that the more we conduct activities in this kind of gray zone between war and peace, between what we traditionally think of as war and what we traditionally think of as peace, and the more we kind of put those activities into the legal framework for war, the more it operates to hide things from the public eye, and the more it operates to shield from any kind of either judicial or democratic scrutiny practices that the American public, much less the rest of the world, might not be very happy about. And one thing I find particularly worrying has been the ways in which, as the U.S. government has sort of defined more and more activities as in the war box, sort of larger and larger chunks of American foreign policy have kind of disappeared into the covert realm. So you and I as ordinary citizens can't find out about them. And take something like people usually talk about in terms of drone strikes, U.S. targeted killings in areas where we are not actively engaged in any sort of familiar combat activity. The United States has used drone strikes and a smaller number of special operations raids and so forth to kill an estimated 4,000 plus people in the last 7 or 8 years. And that's a lot of people to kill. And maybe they're all really bad guys. Maybe they're all terrorists. Maybe they all deserved it. But technically speaking, the U.S. government still has not formally acknowledged doing it in almost all of those cases. Has not said, here are their names, here's why we did it, here are some of the evidence. And I find that, as an American citizen and just as a human being, pretty scary when you have a government that is essentially saying, we get to go around the world choosing who is a bad guy and deserves death, and we don't even have to admit to you that we're the ones who did it, much less tell you why. That's pretty scary.
All right, thanks, Rosa. I want to ask you one question, just a couple of seconds. I'm just curious, how would you describe the feel of the Pentagon? I mean, you're an advisor to the highest-ranking civilian woman at the Pentagon, and I'm just curious about what it's like there.
Well, you know, the first few days I was there, it felt very strange. It felt like sort of working inside the Death Star or something, you know. But it's like everything else, you know. You get used to it, and after a while, it's just the big office building where you work. It's got a food court. It's got a CVS. It has an eye doctor. Yeah, it's basically like a little shopping mall, and there are 23,000 people work in the Pentagon every day. And those 23,000 people need to eat lunch, and they want to pick up some Tylenol and some tissues, and they want to buy flowers for someone's birthday, and they want to buy cakes, and they want to buy running shoes in the Pentagon. Much the same as the military itself now is more or less all things to all people and does everything. The Pentagon itself, anything you might want to buy, you can get there.
I wonder if they watch the soap operas that they help create.
I watched a few of them. They weren't bad.
Really? Okay. All right. Super interesting stuff. We're going to have to end it there. Rosa Brooks, author of the new book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. Rosa, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Sarah Gonzalez filling in for Brian Lehrer. Next up, the New York Education Commissioner warns of an impending teacher shortage. Stay with us.